This is James Dobson. One of the most frequent questions I'm asked by parents, both in counseling sessions and by mail, relates to children's sleep problems. For example, how do you get a toddler to go to bed at night, and what should you do when he absolutely won't? Well, we're going to devote the next half hour to several aspects of this matter of children and sleep. And if you have a child 10 or under, I think this program is going to be of interest to you.
Many parents have asked questions about sleeping patterns in children, and especially how to get their toddlers to go to bed at night. Do you have some advice for parents relating to this general area of sleeping problems?
Gil, expecting a toddler to hop gaily into bed at the end of the day is like expecting a tiger to walk into a zoo and closing the door behind him. You know, it's just not natural. It's not built into his nature. We've talked about this before, but in the first place, a toddler is extremely negative about absolutely everything. He's even negative about the positives in his life. He does not want to put on his coat, and he does not want to go outside, and he does not want to stay in, and he doesn't want to sit in his high chair, and he certainly doesn't want you to leave him with a babysitter. And by all means, under no circumstances, at any time, does he want to go to bed at night. That's just part of toddlerhood, and I think the writer of this letter was keenly aware of the fact that, you know, this is a struggle each evening.
It's as you say, difficult to get a toddler really to do anything that he especially dislikes, isn't it?
Yes, and unfortunately, a parent who lets a toddler make all of his own decisions in these important areas is, I think, abdicating his responsibility to the child. Now, that's a truism that everybody can agree with. But it's amazing to me, Gil, how parents will ask their children if they want to obey. You know, ask a three-year-old, Johnny, do you want to go take your bath now? Would you like to go get in the tub? And of course Johnny does not want to go get in the tub. And I think what a parent is really saying in a situation like that, where she, usually a mother, asks the child if he will consent to following her suggestion, is that she is saying, I don't have the courage to step in and lead. I don't have the courage to assume the authority which gives me the right to say, do it. Therefore, I will suggest it and hope that you see it the same way that I see it. And what's amazing to me about kids, even a three-year-old child, is he can sense that his mother, or in many cases the father, lacks courage, and that they're afraid that if they tell him to do something, he won't do it. And it begins to generate conflict between mother and child. I've seen many examples of it. In fact, I wrote about one in my book, Dare to Discipline, which I think is kind of interesting. Let me quote it to you, which might be of interest to somebody. A mother recently asked for help in handling her defiant three-year-old daughter, Sandy. She had realized that her tiny little girl had hopelessly beaten her in the conflict of wills, and the child had become a tyrant and a dictator. On the afternoon prior to our conversation, an incident occurred which was typical of Sandy's way of doing business. The mother, whom I'll call Mrs. Nichols, put the youngster down for a nap, although it was unlikely that she would stay in bed. Sandy is not accustomed to doing anything that she doesn't want to do, and nap time is not on her acceptable list at the moment. On this occasion, however, the child was more interested in antagonizing her mom than in merely having her own way. Sandy began to scream. She yelled loudly enough to upset the whole neighborhood, fraying Mrs. Nichols' jangled nerves. Then she tearfully demanded various things, including a glass of water. At first, Mrs. Nichols refused to comply with the orders, but she surrendered when Sandy's screaming again reached a peak of intensity. As the glass of water was delivered, the little tigress pushed it aside, refusing to drink because her mother had not brought it soon enough. Mrs. Nichols stood offering the water for a few minutes, then said she would take it back to the kitchen if Sandy did not drink by the time she counted to five. Sandy set her jaw and waited through the count. 3, 4, 5. As Mrs. Nichols grasped the glass of water and walked toward the kitchen, the child again screamed for the water. Sandy dangled her harassed mom back and forth like a yo-yo until she tired of the sport. Now, you see, Mrs. Nichols and her little daughter are among the many casualties of an unworkable, illogical philosophy of child management which has dominated the literature on this subject during the past 20 years. This mother had read that a child will eventually respond to patience and tolerance ruling out the need for discipline. She had been told to encourage the child's rebellion because it offered a valuable release of hostility. And I see that in the literature just all the time, Gil. She attempted to implement the recommendations of the experts, who suggested that she verbalize the child's feelings in a moment of conflict. You want the water, but you're angry because I brought it too late. You don't want me to take the water back to the kitchen. You don't like me because I make you take naps. You wish you could flush Mommy down the toilet. She had been taught that conflicts between parent and child were to be perceived as inevitable misunderstandings and a difference of viewpoint. Unfortunately, Mrs. Nichols and her advisors were wrong, and this is the punchline. She and her child were involved in no simple difference of opinion. She was being challenged, mocked, and defied by her daughter. And for that reason, no heart-to-heart talk would resolve the nose-to-nose confrontation, because the real issue was totally unrelated to the water or the nap or other aspects of the particular circumstance. The actual meaning behind this conflict and 100 others was simply this. Sandy was brazenly rejecting the authority of her mother. And the way Mrs. Nichols handled this confrontation would determine the nature of their future relationship. She could not ignore it. To quote the dilemma expressed by a television commercial, what's a mother to do?
How would you recommend that Mrs. Nichols handled that type of situation?
She had been challenged directly and willfully. She had given an order that was not accepted. Her leadership was on the line. The real question, as I said here, was who's in charge here? And it would have been very wise for Mrs. Nichols to have won that confrontation, to have walked out of the room with the water in hand and shut the door and let Sandy cry herself to sleep. Or if Sandy popped out of bed, to come back and outlast Sandy, perhaps giving her one swat with a little switch, nothing that would be harmful to her in the long run, but put her back in bed and put the switch up on the dresser and show it to Sandy and say, Sandy, you're free to get up. You can get up again, but if you do, you get one more swat and leave the room, but wait right around the corner. If Sandy popped up again, I'd give her one more swat. I would outlast that child. And on that occasion, Sandy would know I was in charge, which is a very important issue. Now, Gil, if I had 6 months, I couldn't tell you how strongly I feel about this. Most of the writers in child development talk about discipline in terms of behavior, as though the objective in a situation like this is to keep Sandy in the bed. And therefore, any way they can keep Sandy in the bed is, they've reached the objective they're shooting for. I see it totally different. The objective is to establish the relationship between Sandy and her mother, to establish her mother as the leader. So when her mother says, Sandy, stop! Sandy stops and doesn't run into the street and is saved from disaster because she heard and obeyed her mother.
You know, I don't know why it is that the tendency is to go just the absolutely opposite direction. You know, that is a constant. It's a given in parent-child relationships that you have to build that relationship rather than that being the one that comes about naturally.
I think that it's a product of our permissive society where authority has been undermined at every level. You know, people just don't believe in it anymore. We disrespect and distrust the authority of the president and the FBI and the CIA and the minister or the priest. Everybody questions the role of authority in our lives, and we question it in the life of a child. But it has a very important role to play. It's the glue that holds civilization together.
How would your advice differ if that child is 2 years of age, let's say, and suddenly began to oppose going to bed? Let's suppose, for example, that he stayed in bed, but maybe he howled for the first time on a given night.
Gil, that's exactly what happens in a typical situation. A child who has gone to bed with a smile on his face for 18 months will suddenly kick and scream bloody murder at about 18 to 20 to 24 months in there. And the first time this happens, parents often suspect that the child has the flu or he has a cold or he's teething or that maybe he has gas problems or something. That it's very curious because he's never done it before, and all of a sudden he's crying and wringing his hands. We experienced this in our own family, where we had gone to a cabin in the mountains with three other families. And here I am writing books on discipline and leadership of children and everything. And our little 18-month-old girl decided she didn't want to go to bed that night. Only she didn't say, "Daddy, I don't want to go to bed tonight." She just cried when we put her in bed. And we thought all kinds of problems were wrong with her. And we worked with her for 2 hours and couldn't identify the problem. We finally decided it must be teething problems, that she had a problem. So we gave her some very hard, crispy Fritos or something like that. And she just chomped them like everything. And we ruled out that last possibility. And suddenly I realized that that youngster was playing games with me. And I gave her one swat. And I said, "Danae, you lie down in that bed and don't you move." And I said it stern. And I walked out of the door and I shut the door behind me and she went to sleep just like that. Mm. It was the first time she'd ever done it. That's what fooled me. And this often happens. Now, in those occasions, if the child screams and you let him get up because you're not accustomed to this, then his behavior has been successful. It's achieved a very desirable result. He hadn't had to go to bed, which most children hate to do. It's going to happen tomorrow night and tomorrow night. And what else parents do, they won't let the child up when he cries softly. And they won't let him up when he cries a little more loudly. And they won't let him up when he's crying very loudly. But when he screams, that reaches a point of agitation, and so they go in and let him up. Now, in terms of what you reinforce, what does that taught the child? Mm-hmm. It doesn't pay to cry quietly. You got to scream, and you make a screamer out of a child.
Yeah.
So in a situation like that now, there's a big difference between a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. With a 2-year-old who has just started to do this, I think it's wise to let him cry. That is exhausting behavior. And the first time he does it, he may cry for 2 hours. And your neighbors will wonder, what in the world is wrong with your child? And they'll tell you the next day, "I know you had sickness in your house last night." But it's not really that. He will just try you. And sometimes his will is stronger than the will of the parents. And I think you just have to outlast him. That is hard work, crying for 2 hours. That's the hardest work in the world. And if it does not achieve results, it won't last more than 2 or 3 days.
Hmm. Dr. Dobson, do you view most parents as just sort of yellow-bellied, spineless wonders? I mean, is the real question courage in coming to grips with situations like this?
There's probably a better word than courage, Gil, and that's confidence. I think many parents will not accept the challenge of a child in that kind of situation because they're not sure they're right. You know, it's very hard to figure out what's going on in the mind of a child. And if it's your first child, you sure don't want to damage him emotionally or physically. And to hear him crying in there for 45 minutes or an hour is just very distressing if you're not sure that what you're doing is in his best interest.
And that's why we don't act decisively on it.
Yes, Dr. Benjamin Spock, of all people, wrote in an article that I read, "Inability to be firm is the commonest problem of parents in America today." And I agree.
Wow.
That's quite a statement.
That is quite a statement. Maybe a balancing point here is needed. You're not, of course, recommending any form of harshness on the part of parents.
No, and that's a frustrating thing for me in talking about a subject of this nature, because people can hear anything they want to hear.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for people to believe that, boy, I just see the parent as this big, gigantic Goliath walking around ready to spank the child or shove him in a dark room and walk off and leave him. That's not what I'm talking about. Please, folks, don't misunderstand me at that point. I'm just saying that a child will ask you if you have the confidence to lead, and especially around this issue of bedtime, and you need to answer the question and say, "Yes, I do." And when I tell you that you have to go to bed, then I want you to go to bed because I have your best interest at heart.
Mm. Okay, let's move up the scale age-wise a few years now. Suppose you have a well-disciplined, happy son or daughter. Let's say that we'll put them at 8 years of age. And the child calls on you one night and says, "Dad, I'm scared here in the dark. Kind of like to get up and come see you or whatever, come crawl into bed with you." How many times have I heard that phrase? What do you say?
Well, again, Gil, you don't want that problem to succeed in postponing bedtime or in allowing the child to get up, because if it works, it'll recur again. On the other hand, you want to be sympathetic, because it is possible for a child to be afraid at night. And I think you need to approach it with a what I would call a counter
fantasy. If you think about it, what's causing the child problems at that moment are negative fantasies. He thinks the shadows are moving, and he imagines that somebody is in that closet, or somebody's calling across the floor, or for whatever reason, the dark is not always empty, you know, and he's imagining things. Sometimes, this won't always work, but I've found it effective, sometimes you can eliminate that problem by giving a more exciting fantasy to work on. For example, to go in and talk to him and say, you know, John, did you know that you're not lying in bed right now? Looks like you are. I mean, everybody would think you are, but you're not lying in bed. You're actually in a cave. And this is the mouth of the cave up here where your head is. And you're not in that cave alone. As a matter of fact, it goes on back, and it's a secret kind of place. And at the back of the cave is a stairway going down. And it goes down about 10 feet and opens into a bright lighted room. And there your mother and your dad and your sisters and your brothers and a bunch of guards and all kinds of people are down there with you. And they've got all kinds of food and good things to eat and things to do, games down there. And when you get tired of being up here, you can just go back and go down that ladder and you can really have a lot of fun down there with all your friends. And there's a glass bubble over the front of the cave. Nobody can get in. Nobody can touch you. You know, you replace his fantasy with one that's more encouraging. I found that sometimes kids really enjoy entering into that fantasy life, and they're asleep in 3 seconds when they start doing that.
I'm afraid I'm the world's greatest pushover on this very question we're talking about. We've got two girls, an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, and particularly the 5-year-old has that little extra measure of daintiness and fragile feminine qualities. And I'll tell you, when she rounds the corner, you know, along about 10 o'clock at night, and says, Daddy, I'm scared. You know, I'd rather be in here with you. It is. I've heard that line a million times, and still every time I've got to fight it to know that the best thing for her is just to stay put.
Along with a lot of warmth at that time, to put your big fatherly arms around her and pull her up close to you and tell her you're right there and you love her, and you provide all of the reinforcement and the satisfaction. You just don't allow the behavior to succeed and allow her to get up.
I wish we weren't just about out of time, because these programs where we're trying to answer direct questions from our listeners are so important. But let me try to cram a couple more in just before we finish. How much sleep should a child get?
Gil, I don't think there's a single answer to that. And it's very difficult to answer because it varies from child to child, and it varies from one age to the other. I think you just have to watch your child. See if he's tired the next day. See if he's yawning at night. See if his eyes are red. Then gear the amount of sleep he gets to what he seems to need. They're just like we are as adults. Some people get along on 4 or 5 hours a night, and some require 8 or 9. And children vary some, too. But generally, I think for elementary school children, they need somewhere between 10 and 12 hours a night.
Let's finish on this. What about children sleeping with their parents?
I think almost every authority in the country on child development would agree that that's a bad idea. It has sexual implications with regard to the mother-father relationship, but it also has dependency implications with a child still being too closely attached to the parents. Sleeping ought to be one of the first elements of independence, where he is learning to exist apart from his mother. And I would not submit to that.